In mere seconds, you will be listening to Improvisations to Go. But first, I must inform you that this podcast would not exist, could not exist, without the support of Aubrey's Restaurant. They'll make it for you to go. Also, thanks to the generous support of Dr. Craig and Debbie Jarvis and their verified hunting poodle, Curly Sue. That's right, verified hunting poodle. So here I am, New Orleans, Louisiana, the Crescent City. Well after Katrina struck, but just mere weeks before the pandemic would hit with full force. Like in jazz music, timing is everything. I'm staying at an Airbnb in Bywater, sharing a room in a house owned by this really gifted photographer. There are fabulous photos everywhere you look. It takes me about 7 minutes to get anywhere in the house because I find it necessary to stop and admire artwork every step of the way. My small, comfortable room with shared facilities is about one-third the cost of a hotel and has four times more vibe. The only problem is there's really nowhere to get breakfast close by. So, I call my pal, Anthony Favre, a five-generation New Orleans native and proud UT graduate. When I ask him, "What are you doing for a living these days?" he says, "He's a waiter with a microphone who goes to other people's meetings." Okay, I don't know what that means, but it sounds really cool. The last time I was here in 2002, I ran into Anthony by chance at a coffee shop. He's the only person I know in New Orleans, and I run into him in a coffee shop. Later that morning, he drops me off at the same coffee shop, and I run into someone else with a Knoxville connection. The point being, I guess, that Anthony's my chauffeur for the morning. He drives me to a place called the Ruby Slipper for breakfast. On the way, I completely ruin and destroy our old pal catch-up vibe by insisting on an interview. I do this a lot to people. And in Anthony's case, I didn't even give him the fun questions. For example, I asked him, "Mr. Favre, describe your least favorite dental procedure." "Mr. Favre, please discuss the worst 3 years of the 100 Years' War, but only do this in French." Or this one, "Mr. Favre, what's the biggest challenge faced by the city of New Orleans?"
The number one challenge in New Orleans is population. The number one challenge in New Orleans is population, and related to population is economic development. Until there's some money in this town that actually gets down to the people in this town, it's hard for people to stay here. It's hard for everyone to make a living, including musicians. And, you know, this is what people have trouble understanding, right? That if you don't have a vibrant economy, it's kind of difficult. And so, and the population challenges of the city are basically, pardon me. Population challenge of the city is that all the stuff that we need to do to fix all the stuff that we need to fix costs actual real money. And so if it costs actual real money, you need a lot more people sort of paying into the system so that the people who are here don't get hit with the full cost of those bills all by themselves. So population is the number one challenge, but population built on economic development is basically the story, and you can't really get musicians paid.
There are people I find it incredibly easy to talk to. He's one of them. We ended up getting into several discussions on breakfast option anxiety, mindless opposition to change, undervaluing and underpaying musicians, the incredible risk of basing your economy on local tourism. Mind you, all of this would play out when the pandemic struck New Orleans, except the breakfast anxiety. Anthony Favre, outstanding conversationalist, waiter with a microphone, and chauffeur, then takes me to the Bean Gallery so I can get my cup of tea and revisit the place where I ran into him by accident in 2002. While I was standing in line, I saw a guy that I was sure I had seen before. I'm pretty good with recognizing faces, terrible with names, but faces, yeah, I know I've seen this face. I asked him, do we know each other? He was sure we had never met, and I was sure that I had seen him. Turns out, we were both right. He was a drummer that I had seen play at the Knoxville Museum of Art a few years before. So what do I do once we reach this point in the conversation? I asked for an interview, and he gave me one.
My name's Aaron Curtis Hill, AaronCurtisHill, and I'm from New Orleans, Louisiana.
And what do you do here?
I'm a musician. I play drums in a band called Weather Warlock.
What's like your scene like the indie rock scene or?
It's thriving right now, and I try to stay connected, but since we tour so much, I'm also kind of one foot in, one foot out. But I can say that right after Katrina, for the first few years, it was slow developing, and you felt like you sort of knew every band in town. It was a real small scene. And now, 10 plus years later, it's just exploded. There's every style and genre has just exploded, and there's just a lot of bands, and there's a lot of things happening. So that's really cool to see. Like it's not as small as it once was, and there's just an explosion of music happening.
What do you think that happened?
I mean, I guess the biggest thing was the storm. I think people were sort of hesitant to come back the first few years, and I think as years passed and we didn't have another major storm or anything like that, people got more and more comfortable with the idea of coming and planting roots here. And little by little, the city just kept growing, and then those communities grow and businesses develop and art and music begins to thrive just as it does anywhere else.
When you talk to folks from New Orleans and you talk long enough, Hurricane Katrina is always likely to make an appearance. It's an event I'm still processing, so I can only imagine what it's like for the people that lived through it. It's definitely a time marker, and it almost wiped out one of the richest musical scenes on the planet. But it did not wipe out New Orleans music. I vividly remember watching Hurricane Katrina and the aftermath unfold on television. It was like watching a slow-motion horror film, and I kept yelling at the television, but I couldn't stop it. I have to admit, out of that experience, I really lost a lot of optimism about how well equipped we are in this country to handle disaster. The loss I felt from Katrina was almost theoretical. For Dr. Michael White, his loss was real and direct. He poured that experience into what has become one of my favorite recordings, Blue Crescent. Turns out, that's his favorite recording that he's ever made.
That's my favorite CD. And the reason is, it's my first post-Katrina CD, and all of the songs on there except for one or two are original. And it was based on the emotions I had as a result of Hurricane Katrina. I had lost my home, everything I owned. I had a very valuable archive of materials. I mean, I lost things that were unimaginable. I had a lot of sheet music, thousands of CDs and recordings. I lost over 60 clarinets. Some of them were very valuable. Some of them had belonged to, noted jazz musicians. I lost things like I had this classic white clarinet mouthpiece that belonged to Sidney Bechet, which he's photographed with a lot. And then I had a trumpet mouthpiece from Jabal Smith, Louis Armstrong's greatest rival in the 1920s. He wasn't from New Orleans, but I had met Jabal Smith in his later years, several times, and I ended up with one of his mouthpieces, and I lost that, and, I had interviewed a lot of the older musicians I knew. I lost all of those things, so it was pretty devastating. But even worse than that, worse than all of those losses, the displacement and recovery process. I was in Houston, Texas, and that was so difficult. Very stressful, very depressing, worrying about the condition of New Orleans, the future of New Orleans, people of New Orleans. I had known of so many people that died, either drowned in the storm, like some of the musicians that I knew and played with, people that died from heartbreak and depression, of having to leave the city, some of them for the first time, being older, not knowing what to do, and they just died. Some people died from infections that they got in the toxic water being rescued. Some people committed suicide that I knew. And so it was a very difficult time. The future was uncertain of the city, of the people, of the culture. And it was no easy end in sight in trying to come back and see what would happen. And so the whole idea of Blue Crescent, the title, was that the color blue means a lot of things. You know, it can mean blue as in the blues. It can mean imply sad and slow and mournful. Or it could be blue like a clear blue sky with clarity and beauty and hope and joy and looking toward the future, or like blue in the ocean. So, you know, I think New Orleans was in the state of having all of those different meanings of blue as its condition. So I tried to capture that in the different songs. There's only one song that's really, to me, really sad and mournful, and that's the song Katrina, which I can't really play or listen to anymore because it recalls everything for me.
Dr. White's record is on Basin Street Records, a great record label headed by Mark Samuels. It boasts an incredible lineup that also includes Kermit Ruffins and Irvin Mayfield and dozens of other wonderful folks. After Katrina flooded his house, he ended up running the whole operation out of a coffee shop at one point.
So we have had to evacuate for hurricanes on a number of occasions, and this was one that, and I've usually fought my family on leaving because it is a lot of work to leave town. This was one that I did not need to be told twice. So we went to Memphis and we evacuated there. And when the hurricane passed, everything was okay. And what eventually devastated New Orleans was the failure of three canal walls, which were poorly engineered and poorly maintained and had absolutely nothing to do with a hurricane, other than they were full and the walls fell down. So New Orleans was treated differently as a result of the fact that it was not just a hurricane. Going back for a second here, what gave me personally the ability to deal with it, and really looking back now, I say relatively painless way, is that I had already endured a tragedy that was significantly worse than anything that I experienced as a result of the levees break. And that's that in 2000, my wife died and in a car accident, and I watched her pass away. And then I raised three children who were all injured as well for several years on my own. So I knew that there was, at that point that Katrina came along, I had met a new girlfriend, and I knew there was a light at the end of the tunnel. And I knew that, and so those things, those skills that I gathered as a result of the first tragedy, this one was really not the Katrina was not a really a big deal for me personally. But I hate saying that, knowing also that there were 1,800 people that died when the levees broke, including Irvin Mayfield's father, who was a drowning victim. And it was a terrible tragedy, and something that just I hope we all take lessons from, but we don't seem to.
I admit, it's hard not to share that opinion watching this pandemic unfold in slow motion, just like it was watching Hurricane Katrina. But here we are. And there I was in New Orleans, feeling just a little down, so I thought I'd go see Kermit Ruffins. I try not to lock people into some preconceived image I have of them before I meet them. I try, but not really very hard. I pretty much always lock people into some preconceived image. In the case of Kermit Ruffins, I imagine him to be laid back, genuine, friendly, warm, funny, and possessing a lot of heart. nailed it. I showed up a few minutes early at his new bar, Kermit's 9th Ward Juke Joint in the Holy Cross area. Before I got there, I went to St. Claude Fresh Market to grab a snack and, you know, maybe some dried pretzels or something. And I ended up having another unbelievable meal. This one just in the back of the grocery store. They were cooking up all this amazing food. I just pointed to it and said, "Come to me, come to me," and it did. It's like magic. I mean, come on, even the grocery stores have home-cooked food. Once I was full, I walked down the block and there was Kermit, sitting in his bar, relaxed and ready to talk, as construction workers were putting some of the finishing touches on his new bar.
You know, I am blessed enough to be raised right around the corner from here. Mom and dad, grandmother, grandfather, I mean, we would go fishing on Saturday mornings, maybe every other week, 4 a.m. We all up going fishing and crabbing. We back in the backyard by 11 a.m. Music cranked up, the barbecue grill going. We cleaning crabs, we cleaning fish, we freezing some, we cooking some. Everybody's drinking some good beers in the yard. I mean, we cleaning turtles and raccoon and just preparing for Christmas or Thanksgiving or whatever it may be, or just a normal freaking weekend on any given weekend. And I don't know how else how to live, but it's like I wake up with a frame of mind. It's a family reunion picnic every day. When I hit the stage, years ago, I always put in my head that I'm playing at my family reunion picnic. What would I do with my grandfather, my grandmother, and my mom sitting there? How would I show off for them? So that it just happens now without me even thinking about it. At one time, I just forced myself to think like that, just to say, hey man, this is a freaking picnic every day. So let's barbecue, so we can smell that barbecue. Let's put on some oldie but goodie music, Earth, Wind & Fire, before the show. I tell every venue, put on Earth, Wind & Fire, or Al Green, or the Commodores. I want that music before I go on stage. I tell every venue the same thing, because it brings me back to my childhood, to the point where you're free when it's time to go to work, which is not work, you know. You're throwing a party every day of the week. I've been throwing a party every day of the week for about 40 years now, or more. I mean, a little less of it. And that's just the way I look at it, only because of my upbringing from my mom, dad, grandmother, and grandfathers, you know.
I bet they'd be proud.
Yes.
One thing that really strikes me about a Kermit Ruffin show is the band itself. They just have a great ease with each other. That probably comes from the fact they've been playing together for decades.
Yeah, we're the only band, I think, on earth that never had an argument. When we see each other, it's a freaking party. We're rolling up reefers, we're drinking beers, flirting with the ladies, you know, just laughing at our friends that we've known since high school. I'm blessed to have a bunch of high school friends come to my bar every day. The same people I knew since I was 17, 18 years old. I'm still hanging with them almost every freaking day. So even my drummer went to high school with me. Kevin, he didn't go to high school with me, but he's been playing with me that long too. And we, man, it's a bunch of laughter and jokes. It's just the silliest band on earth, guaranteed. With zero practice, zero rehearsal, I'll text them a song, and we just rehearse right on the people. It'll be a full house. If we go screwed up, we just stop the freaking band, everybody laugh, and we'll go to another song.
Kermit Ruffin, thanks.
Thank you, man.
Yeah, man.
I appreciate you.
We'll see you tonight.
Thank you.
I'll try to be in the right frame of mind.
Yeah. Picnic frame of mind.
Kermit Ruffin's, to me, is New Orleans, and I can't imagine going there without seeing him perform. Luckily, he's usually performing a couple of nights a week, at least. I caught him at his other club the Mother-in-Law Lounge. The incredible, colorful, vibrant artwork on the side of the building tells you exactly what you're in for. Mother-in-Law Lounge is a really friendly, intimate place. It's got a big pole in the middle of the stage. There isn't a stage, really. They're just standing there on the floor right in front of you. And then it's like Vaughn's, where anybody can come in, and everybody does. And everybody that's there is trying to do the same thing. Attain that special level of consciousness. Picnic frame of mind. The night I was there, I shared a table with a couple from Greece. They had just arrived by plane in New Orleans from Athens, Greece. This was their first event and their first trip to the United States, and I thought, wow, Kermit Ruffins is going to let you know what the United States is all about. And he did. It was just a wonderful show. He had guest artists. He interacted with everybody there. There were some jokes, which I can't repeat. Not because they're not suitable for this podcast, just because it wouldn't be funny if I said it. When I finally got back to the Airbnb, I was exhausted and reflecting upon all the things I had taken in that day, almost too many to mention. And it reminded me that there's two ways to travel, really. One is, you know, what I call the beach travel, where you go to the beach, you sit in a chair, you look at the water, and you go, ah, nothing wrong with that kind of trip. I miss that kind of trip right now. And then there's the other kind of trip where I go and I try to cram every single ounce of the city or place into my very being. And it's, you know, it's always impossible, but I love trying. Right before I drifted off to sleep, I kept thinking again about Katrina. It's just always sort of echoing in the back of my mind. And how do you bounce back from these catastrophes, these just unparalleled disasters? And I'm thinking about that right now. You know, we're going through one right now, almost in slow motion. And maybe our friends from New Orleans have an answer for us. Maybe all they've been through, they can help us out with some advice or a friendly tune. And I remembered my conversation with Dr. Michael White and how he talked about finding the way back.
Yeah, there is an arc in Blue Crescent, and it is a story about, you know, what we have, what we lost, what we want to see, and how we can recover. And, you know, one of the songs that people like a lot these days and I keep in the repertoire is the song Sunday Morning. Because what that song does, in one sense, I thought about the old Sunday morning church parade tradition that we used to have. And it was like the second line, but a little tamer. It was, you know, churches that would come together for pastors' anniversaries, religious holidays, the founding of a new church. And they would have a song, they would have a parade, and we would play up-tempo, jazzed-up versions of hymns on the Sunday morning. And it was such a beautiful thing, and there was such a sense of power and peace and people coming together to worship, you know, and looking for strength through the Creator. And so, you know, I wrote the song Sunday Morning as a joyous up-tempo hymn with that in mind. The idea of people in New Orleans coming together through strength and faith to rebuild the city and their lives.
These are crazy, weird, scary times right now. And I hope you're doing okay out there, because we got more traveling to do, okay? I'm Todd Steed. I'll see you at the train station.
Improvisations to Go is a production of WUOT. Original music for this podcast was created by Daniel Kimbrough, Hunter Deacon, David Dayoub, and Todd Steed claims he was in there somewhere too. This episode featured the music of Kermit Ruffins and Dr. Michael White. If you love the music you hear on this podcast, please feel free to support it in whatever manner you deem appropriate. If you don't like the music on this podcast, don't tell anybody. Improvisations to Go exists because of the generosity of Dr. Craig and Debbie Jarvis, not to mention Curly Sue, the only confirmed hunting poodle in East Tennessee. Thanks for the beautiful support of the following spectacular places to wine and dine: Aubrey's, Sunspot, Drink, and Bistro by the Tracks. According to Todd Steed, this podcast was written and produced by Todd Steed. You'll have to take his word for it. I'm Chrissy Kuiper. That, I can pretty much assure you, is 100% true.